Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to Rosa Luxemburg, the speed dating version. In 1907, Rosa Luxemburg and Clara Zetkin, whose birthday it also is today, all the best ones are born on the 5th of July, went for a short walk and lost track of time and ended up being late for an appointment with August Seebruch, who was one of the main personalities then in the SPD party, in which they were both active. Rosa composed their epitaph saying, "Here lie the two last men of German social democracy." Little anecdote, but quite telling of her life and times and the place from which her work on women comes from, which is going to be the theme on which I'm speaking. So Rosa Luxemburg was born in Poland as a subject of the Russian Empire. She was Jewish, she was disabled from childhood. At the same time, she gained a PhD in 1897, only 20 years after the first woman was admitted to University of Zurich, where she was enrolled. So she was a woman ahead of her times in many ways. At the same time, the first and most important thing I'm going to mention is that she was first and foremost a socialist. She was first and foremost a Marxist. That was the emphasis of her work. Her relationship to gender, her relationship to women came out of that approach. The period in which she works alongside Zetkin, alongside another great of that time, Eleanor Marx, the youngest daughter of Karl Marx, whose recent biography, I commend to you if you don't know it, foremother of socialist feminism really, was marked by a very central position of women organizing internationally, at the same time women being largely barred from education. All three women at that point did not have the right to vote, so it's a very contradictory position towards rights, gender, etc. A few main strands I want to emphasize before I go into the actual work. For all women, who I'm going to talk about together and see kind of a relationship between them, one main thing that underpinned their work was internationalism. You don't look at struggles separately. You don't look at local struggles and try to fight a certain battle. At the same time, very much related to that, they understood oppression as something that is connected between all struggles. So again, you don't sort of fight women's rights today, socialist struggles tomorrow, anti-imperialism. As I said, Rosa was herself a subject of empire. She was a very strong first person to take over to expand Marx's work on imperialism. And that came from kind of very personal relationship to empire. But that was all kind of intermeshed together. The third thing, and that is uniquely Rosa and puts her very differently, I think, to both Clara Zetkin and Eleanor Marx, is the emphasis on revolution. So one of the volumes that is here today, and I know some of my co-panelists will talk about expansively as well, is this volume that looks at Rosa's work on the 1905 revolution in Russia, which is a series of events that came out of strikes, uprisings, basically dissent against the Tsar, dissent against authoritarianism. For Rosa, and here I'm very much indebted, I have to say it's a real honor for me to speak here because my work is very much indebted to all the people sitting here on the podium. She was a champion of revolution, of Marxism, but also of democracy as a running strand through that. And in this writing, in this volume of writing, you really see that emphasis. And again, when she writes about women, when she advocates for women, she is talking, yes, focus on revolution, focus of bringing a world that is not yet here, but maintaining democratic practice throughout and championing democracy throughout. It's not something that can happen besides. So I'm going to speak a little bit on a text called Russian Women Workers in Battle. And I say a little bit, really a little bit. I'm going to read for you a few quotes so you can kind of get the grasp of where her approach to women comes from. "Whoever needs convincing that women are just as capable as men of experiencing both citizenship in high sense and the noblest of civic virtues would do well to study the history of liberation struggles that have shaken Russia since the abolition of serfdom. The revolution is a place where you can really test and see people's ability for agency, for organization. When people take to the streets and organize strikes, then you see their quality in civic rights, in civic struggles. So this is a very, very important moment in which she understands women's rights. The revolutionary moment, again from her, the revolutionary movement relates to these women as bearers of culture in the broader sense of that word. Not only does it enlighten them socially and politically, not only does it steal their character by enjoining them in the principles of solidarity and self-sacrifice, but it also teaches them the most basic skills of reading, writing, arithmetic, etc. So the emphasis on education, on organizing, comes through the revolutionary moment itself, never outside of it, never again as a separate struggle. As opposed to Eleanor Marx and Clara Zetkin, who are both known as feminists, kind of championed women's rights independently. Rosa's relationship to gender was a little bit more complex, but again, if you look at these writings, you see that she never underestimated the need to organize for women. And that's what you get. The Russian woman proletarian has become enlisted as a regular member of the fighting international proletariat. And when the Russian revolutionary movement has achieved its immediate goal of toppling absolutism, which will leave the road free for the toughest battle against capitalism, when the morning of political freedom dawns for those millions who are still tamed today by our little father's lash, then Russian women workers will deserve a good deal of credit for the spoils of victory. So women are at the forefront of the struggle. Women are those who are leading the way. Now, this came in 1905, but is no fluke. It's nothing that is extraordinary in her work. I'm going to read a little bit from a text that comes in 1912 called Women's Suffrage and Class Struggle. In truth, and here she's writing about Germany, where she's operating. In truth, our state is interested in keeping the vote in working women and from them alone. Women's suffrage is a horror and abomination for the present capitalist state because behind it stand millions of women who would strengthen the enemy within, i.e. a revolutionary social democracy. So it's really understanding the power of working women, of those who are most oppressed, who are those who are most outside of the struggle, in mobilizing and creating a revolutionary moment within social democracy. Now, working on Rosa Luxemburg, and I think that's something that a lot of us share in approach, really teaches cohesive approach for history, of understanding the force of history and one's placement organizing within it. And looking at these quotes and looking at this approach to socialist feminism, really at its inception, is quite educational in understanding, first of all, as I said, the interconnectivity of struggles. Secondly, the unequivocal focus on internationalism, never to just look at one country separate from the rest of the world. But more than anything, the kind of connectivity of oppressions and how all of those have to be battled together. So looking at this argument today, and looking at how she saw women workers as those who are most threatening to social democracy because they're those who are most excluded, obviously we can translate that to thinking, who are the women who are most excluded from the public sphere today? So it was lucky to attend a panel earlier talking about suppression of votes, talking about things that are happening now, I know, here and elsewhere. So I think one thing that we can take on from that work and think about towards the future, towards where we are now, if she was here in the panel, she would be like, yeah, that's all great what I wrote 100 years ago, but what about what's going on right now? is the insistence of looking at women as those who are bearing the brunt of being outside of social democracy at the most extreme, but again, thinking about who are those women? So working women then, now we can obviously think about various other categories in which we see women completely excluded from the public sphere. So what I'd like to end on is thinking about how we look at this triangle, which I'd like to state is of her relationship to women workers, revolutionary movement, social democracy, internationalism, and think about how we can place these struggles together and women who are carrying this message forward. Today we're living in a hugely harsh time, obviously here in America, around the world, the rise of the far right, the rise of nationalism, things that she fought her entire life again. But we're also living in a world in which women such as Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are mobilizing really important struggles and sort of taking this message of the women who are pushed outside of social democracy, championing them, championing their votes. I'm going to end on a very short quote from her that I think is kind of worth thinking about. She writes, "History will do its work, see that you do your work." So I think the last message I'd like to leave you with is thinking about who are those women who are most threatening to social democracy. Let's champion their work. Thank you.
Comrades, I'm apologetic. I'm going to read my remarks. I'll give you a dramatic reading. Here goes.
I expect no less.
Yeah, no less, yes. After a few general remarks, I will connect the historical record. After a few general remarks, I will correct the historical record about something Rosa Luxemburg did not say. And from there, we'll consider advice on political strategy that she seems to offer socialist activists of today, to be found in the volumes 2 and 5 of her collected works, which I helped edit. I want to begin with an appeal that we engage with Luxembourg in the manner she deserves. This has several aspects. One involves opening our minds and hearts to her. And for many of us, this is incredibly easy, given her vibrant sensibilities, her energy, her personal and intellectual animation and depth, and the very way she talks to us in her writings. Another involves trying to understand what she actually said and meant and did, as opposed to settling for a Rosa simply of our own making. I have heard people describe Rosa Luxemburg essentially as a utopian radical feminist, or as a rigidly Marxist anti-feminist. I have heard people talk about her, and quite positively, as if her thinking was compatible with Emma Goldman's anarchism, or Edward Bernstein's social democratic reformism, or Deng Xiaoping's bureaucratic state capitalism. She's also very frequently cast in the role of Lenin's most magnificent enemy in some cosmic morality play. One can get negative, too. Simply because Luxemburg is a Marxist, believing in the class struggle and opposing capitalism, she is, for some on the right, a precursor of Joseph Stalin and a herald of horrific tyranny. Among some on the left, she is criticized as a woolly-minded spontaneist who does not understand the need for organization in the revolutionary struggle. Luxemburg was qualitatively different from and more interesting than any of this, and she deserves better from us. Related to this, she deserves from us an effort to make use of what she's actually offering us. She was brilliant, insightful, with considerable knowledge and practical experience. She said and wrote things that are worth comprehending, actively considering, and testing out as we try to understand and change the world around us. Through our engagement with her, we must treat her as a person, not as a revolutionary goddess. Just because she thinks or says or writes something does not necessarily make that something true. It is possible that she could be wrong. Given her humanity is in it, it is inevitable that she would get some things wrong. It has been argued intelligently that she got certain things terribly, even disastrously wrong. And such arguments deserve serious consideration. I should add that from my own experience, even when I conclude she was wrong about something, it is not the case that she was wrong about every aspect of that something. Her mind and insights are so good that one can learn from her even when she is partly or largely wrong. She deserves being taken seriously. We owe that to her and to ourselves as well. Now I want to quote from one of Luxembourg's comrades, with whom she sometimes crossed swords, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. Here is something Lenin wrote about her, which has been quoted over and over and over again, and then some. Here's what Lenin said. Not only will communists all over the world cherish her memory, but her biography and her complete works will serve as useful manuals for training many generations of communists all over the world. Quote, since this still is the quote within Lenin's quote, quote, since August 4th, 1914, social democracy has been a stinking corpse, unquote. This statement will make Rosa Luxemburg's name famous in the history of the international working class movement. That's Lenin. The 1914 reference is to the eruption of World War I and to the betrayal by the leaders of Luxemburg's party, the German Social Democratic Party of Germany, in supporting this imperialist war, Indeed, there are revolutionary-minded people today who wag a finger at those who joined Democratic Socialists of America while repeating this Luxembourg quote, "Social democracy is a stinking corpse." A problem with this is it seems to be Lenin's formulation. As we editors have pored through all that Luxembourg wrote, we've not been able to find those words. She was always very critical of the increasing non-revolutionary orientation of the SPD leadership, and starting in 1914, doubly and triply so. And at the end of her life, she helped to form the German Communist Party. But for most of her life, with varying degrees of patience and impatience, she labored to win working class comrades of the social democracy to a revolutionary Marxist orientation. She warned them of what she called the twin evils. One was cutting themselves off from the mass of workers and their struggles, maintaining their purity as a little revolutionary-minded sect. The other evil was adapting to opportunities offered by shrewd capitalist politicians, with the result of turning the socialist organization into a party of bourgeois social reform. In her battle against reformism, she by no means opposed the struggle for reforms, changes for the better within the framework of capitalism. The problem with reformism, she insisted, is that it seeks simply to pile up one reform after another with the intention of gradually, painlessly transitioning to a more just and humane society. Luxembourg saw winning reforms as essential to building a strong and self-confident working class movement capable of overturning capitalism and replacing it with socialism. As she put it, the struggle for reforms is its means, the social revolution its aim. Luxembourg's analysis of the economic dynamics of the capital accumulation process, to be found in volume 2 of her collected works, indicates that reformist gradualism is impossible, that it can't be achieved. She describes capitalism's global expansion as capital's relentless war on the social and economic interrelations of the world's peoples, and the violent looting of their means of production and their labor power. She emphasized the destructive impact of all this, the ravenous greed, the voracious appetite for accumulation, the very essence of which is to take advantage of human realities with no thought for tomorrow. Imperialism, militarism, and war are essential to the capitalist system that Luxembourg describes and analyzes. We must now add to this environmental degradation. This leads, as she put it, to the destruction of all culture, or, if not that, a transition to the socialist mode of production. The fifth volume of her works highlights the pathway that Luxembourg argued could lead to this final transitional victory of social democracy, that is, for her, socialism. It was transitional not simply in the sense of leading from the capitalist to the socialist form of economy, but in the way working class consciousness and workers' struggles should develop, with struggles for reforms that can actually flow into the social revolution. Mass struggles to protect people's dignity and quality of life generate what she called a lovely madness among the workers, the vision that a huge effort full of sacrifices can result in a socialist ordering of society. Luxembourg called upon the party and trade unions of Germany to help prepare the intellectual spirit and idealism among the masses of workers that all struggles that we conduct, all mass strikes that lie in front of us, are nothing other than a necessary historical stage towards the ultimate liberation from capitalism, on the way to the socialist order. She told us, we can only grow through struggle, and it's in the middle of struggle that we learn how to fight. My time is up, but these words are worth taking to heart as we labor to rebuild our socialist movement. and, with a lovely madness, reach for a future of the free and the equal. Learning how to fight through engaging in the actual struggles of today and tomorrow. Thank you.
So, being a Canadian, I can tell you that the number of people in this room in the United States of America gives me hope. So yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming out. So it is an extreme pleasure to be here today and to share a seat with these panelists. Paul did not disappoint. He's fired us up. And now I'm going to hopefully not lose the fire, but talk a little bit more specifically about Luxembourg in regard to the mass strike. I come to the works of Rosa Luxemburg via the Marxist humanist philosophy of Raya Donevskaya. For me, it was telling that in the 1940s, when Trotsky and Lenin were all the rage, that Donevskaya turned to the works of Rosa Luxemburg in a serious way. Now, she wasn't alone, but her own engagement with Luxemburg was different from other activists and theorists of the time. To my reading, Donevskaya was able to address what she saw as theoretical errors made by Luxembourg without losing sight of Luxembourg's most important contributions. And I think Paul highlighted that beautifully just now. And, as he also noted, it's sometimes hard to overcome the romantic Rosa in favor of the much more complex economist, revolutionary theoretician, philosopher, and feminist, which is important. It means understanding the totality of Luxembourg rather than episodic events that usually focus on her imprisonment or her martyrdom. One of the significant limitations that we have faced in the past when trying to engage Luxembourg as a thinker in her own right was access to materials and, in particular, access to reliable translations of her work. In the forthcoming volume 4 of her complete works in English, we're able to engage Luxembourg's key ideas around the 1905 Russian Revolution. In fact, many of these have never been available in English before or anything other than Polish. So this is really opening up our eyes. I'm going to talk about a couple of those essays and one you might be familiar with, which is the well-known pamphlet on the mass strike, the party, and trade unions. What I've enjoyed about working in this new translations is that I think we are starting to finally hear Luxembourg's voice. She's often been really translated and highly mediated. So when you get a chance, please check these volumes out. So in my brief time today, I'm going to highlight Luxembourg's thinking about mass action and how she drew her insights from the self-organization of people engaged in the Russian Revolution in what was a very different way than the leadership of social democracy at the time. So just to ensure that we're all starting from the same place, recall that the 1905 Russian Revolution was an attempt to overturn the Tsar and the absolutist state that raged across imperialist Russia. While we tend to think of this as the significant St. Petersburg strike or uprising, you might have heard about it in 1905, Luxembourg's writings in this period are very careful to trace that this is the realization or a culmination of events that she traces back to the 1890s, and if you really want to push, you can go right to the French Revolution. So this is a historical trajectory. I think it's also common for us to think about the revolution of 1905, if we think about it at all, as a failure, or at best, just the prelude to 1917. And I think that we have to think about it differently. It's not simply lessons to be learned as we lead up to the real revolution. In fact, 1905 was fundamental to Luxembourg's thinking about spontaneity and organization. It was a dramatic turning point historically, not only for Russian society, but for European social democracy more broadly. It actually shaped the debates of the time. And I think most significantly, as Paul alluded to, there are moments that she's engaged with in 1905 that absolutely resonate with the questions and political challenges we face today, both organizationally and philosophically. So So for the remainder of my time, I want to address three questions very briefly from her works. And this is specific to this period. What were the masses seeking in the 1905 revolution? Those demands and how they are characterized matter. How does the Russian Revolution of 1905 change the approach of workers and the content of revolution? Is there a different history that we've maybe overlooked? And perhaps most importantly, what can we draw from Luxembourg's thinking about the mass strike today? So, what were they thinking? She notes in great detail that the St. Petersburg uprising was not the start of the Russian Revolution, as I suggested, but the culmination of mostly spontaneous and largely economic strikes across imperialist Russia. She notes in an article for the Polish paper Red Flag in January 1906, where she commemorates 1 year of the revolution, that the violent suppression of the St. Petersburg uprising is what sets off mass actions across imperialist Russia, where she praises, of course, the Polish as being the start where social democracy had taken hold. And she says, it was the first time in the history of Tsarism and the history of the proletariat around the world that a mass of workers this gigantic, spread over such a large area, had stood up at a single command to fight for a common purpose. She sees this as the proletariat rising up to demand freedom. She says it's only in the days that follow that political freedom and the 8-hour workday become the slogan. But this is a broader demand. So what were they seeking? They were seeking freedom. So how does the Russian Revolution of 1905 change the approach of workers and the content of revolution? Historically, Luxembourg notes, the mass strike was seen as a key tactic of the anarchists, and they saw it as the only way to revolution. And among social democracy, the mass strike was sort of, well, we could say poo-pooed. Yeah, maybe it was desirable if the party called it, maybe for a political purpose, but it was not going to be the way to a revolution. What Luxembourg came back to the party and said is that 1905 demonstrated that the masses would spontaneously respond to the violence they were experiencing, in this case in St. Petersburg, with general strikes that spread. And in fact, she notes that it is the Polish workers who responded. So it's not a locality, but it actually has resonance in a broader sense. But it doesn't stop with workers. What happens in 1905 is that it's followed by a mutiny among Navy, Potemkin, the refusals of soldiers to fire on workers and the general public who are setting up barricades, and peasant uprisings demanding access to better land. This is not a one moment or simply an economic strike. This is something of a new character, she says. In her reflection on the year of the revolution, Luxembourg makes an important point that not only are various sectors drawn into the political challenge of absolutism, as I said, soldiers, peasants, not only do the people reject the Tsar's offers of freedom and a constitutional Duma, but the movement itself grows in maturity and is still informed by social democracy. So this isn't just the spontaneity she gets accused of. This is a real engagement between workers spontaneously uprising, but learning from the organizational thinking of a party, which then also influences the party's concept of organization. Or, as she warns, if it doesn't influence the party's concept of organization, the party is missing the revolution. And that, I think, is really the key of this period, that if you don't have a real engagement between theory and practice, and Rosa Luxemburg was living it, then you're really not part of the revolution. So what can we draw from her work on the mass strike, her engagement with social democracy, her battles? And I'm not going to talk about unions today, but it's a very fundamental part of this. In general, I think Luxemburg points our attention to how people spontaneously respond to injustice, oppression, and political exclusion. And she wants us to understand there is no single abstract mass strike. She says that these activities will always vary by locality and that the general character of the action itself will alter over the course of the revolution. In other words, being blindly adherent to a program will not result in a successful revolution. As Luxembourg wrote, there can be no, quote, unbidden schoolmasters of revolution. This said, Luxembourg was clear that a successful revolution can only be carried out by a self-aware proletariat, one that learns, engages in self-critique, and is engaged by social democracy, which was the party of the time. She was also resolute that democratic practice must be the ground for revolutionary practice. Ultimately, she argues that the mass strike emerges in the Russian Revolution not because of absolutism, but because of the particular stage of capitalist development and class relations. In other words, we cannot propose an organizational solution to realize socialism that is not congruent to the particular formation of capitalist society at the moment. Luxembourg is not calling on us to emulate the activities of the Russian Revolution of 1905, but to understand why these particular spontaneous uprisings and movements were the product of their time. So for us as people engaged with the question of socialism, I think her real message is here, we have to pay attention to what the masses are doing. Thank you. Yes.
Well, Rosa Luxemburg is very well known, but only now can we begin to really know her. This is because in the last 5 years alone, over 1,800 pages of her writings in German that were previously completely unknown have been discovered and published by Dietz Verlag in Berlin, as well as 3,000 additional pages of her writings in Polish, which nobody knew of, and which now are becoming available. Moreover, only 25% of her writings that were known prior to the last 5 years have been translated to English. So now that all of her writings will appear in the complete works of Rosa Luxemburg in 17 volumes, ours is, if we live that long, ours is the first generation that will be in the position to get to know her entire body of thought. So here I'm only going to discuss two recently discovered Polish writings by her in terms of what they tell us about her view of the form that is best suited for effecting and achieving the transition to socialism. Luxembourg is often heralded as well as attacked for emphasizing spontaneous mass struggles, but as the earlier speakers have emphasized, she did not counterpose spontaneity and organization. She adhered to the need for a political party as much as any other Marxist. Where she differed from many of them, such as Kautsky and Lenin, was regarding the form of the relationship between spontaneity and organization. For her, the proper form is to enlighten the masses rather than lecturing them like a schoolmaster. Organizations, for her, play a critical role in fostering consciousness among the masses of the ills of capitalism and what the content of a socialist society would actually be. And that consciousness has to be developed, she held, long before the spontaneous revolts actually occur, because spontaneity itself requires an organization of thought that precedes it. But the question is, exactly how is that class consciousness to be developed? Now, she addressed this directly in an article written in Polish in 1906 entitled Critique in the Workers' Movement. I quote it as follows. She states, this is Luxembourg, during the fight, as the proletariat bears down on its enemy, it learns, it educates itself. A victorious outcome depends on the degree of that consciousness. How then do members of the proletariat become conscious? They read pamphlets, appeals, and periodicals. They listen to speeches by people who give advice on various things. They must weigh for themselves which of these things is right, for such consideration is the basis for choosing what path to take, end quote. But that raises a question for us, right? What ensures that the masses will choose the right path? Well, she responds as follows, and I quote her. She says, the freedom to speak and publish is one precondition to the attainment of consciousness by the proletariat. The second is that the proletariat not put any restrictions on itself. That is to say, we can discuss this, but we can't discuss that. Conscious workers the world over understand this, she says. and they always tried to give even the worst of their enemies the right to freely explain their views. They say, let even the enemies of the working people voice their own views, so that we may respond to them, and so that the working masses can work out for themselves who is a friend and who is a foe, end quote. Now, this notion that even the worst of their enemies be given the right to freely express their views later became central 10 years later to a critique of the Bolsheviks in 1918, when she attacked them for closing down opposition newspapers and parties, including of the anti-capitalist left. However, one does not have to wait for that critique to know that the inseparability of democracy and socialism was part of her distinctive contribution. Now, this doesn't mean, I think, that she was a starry-eyed idealist. She knew that workers often make wrong decisions. She spent much of her life engaged in lengthy disputes with party members and trade unionists who opposed radical tactics like the mass strike, as well as attacking those who capitulated to national chauvinism during World War I. But she held that unless the socialist movement is defined by an open-ended, democratically conducted battle of ideas that directly involves the masses, no social transition to socialism in any form is possible. Now, she spells this out in a really amazing essay of 1908, again in Polish, entitled The Lessons of the Three Dumas. Here she follows Marx and Engels in arguing that the form that is best suited for making the transition to socialism is a democratic republic. She does not mean by this a bourgeois democracy, such as we have here, in which we have limited political liberties and zero economic liberties. She attacks reformist socialists who seek a peaceful parliamentary road to socialism on the grounds that it leaves the social relations of production in the hands of capitalists. And that's, of course, why all efforts to capture state power from above and impose socialism through administrative or electoral measures in the end is bound to fail, because the real power of capital lies not in the state, but in the economic relations of civil society. And the past 100 years have confirmed her view. I mean, how many times have leftists won elections only to quickly compromise with the system and embrace capital? It's not an accident, it's inevitable. As long as the capture of political power does not immediately lead to expropriation of the property, the wealth, and the economic power are the personifications of capital. Only then is a truly democratic republic possible. But at the same time, she attacks socialists who think that a transition to socialism can bypass democratic liberties or independent representative bodies. This is, of course, how Marxist-Leninists understood the dictatorship of the proletariat, but neither Marx nor Luxembourg advocated a dictatorship of a party over the proletariat, as existed in every single supposedly socialist or communist regime since 1917. The dictatorship of the proletariat, she argues, is the rule of the immense majority, the oppressed, at the expense of the minority, the capitalists, who are divested, by force if necessary, of control of the means of production. But this social uprooting can only succeed if there is thoroughgoing democracy, since socialism is the first and only social system that is created through the free, conscious will of masses of people. It does not emerge through blind economic laws. That's why, for Marx and Luxembourg, the dictatorship of the proletariat must take the form of a democratic republic. I would add here that, in this sense, authoritarian socialists, statist socialists, Marxist, Leninist, etc., make the same error as reformist socialists. Both view the state as the independent variable, and the control of which determines the course of society, when in fact it's the other way around. The state is the dependent variable, since it's a reflection of the contradictions of civil society. But is it guaranteed that a democratic republic that ensures economic as well as political liberty will actually lead to the creation of socialism? Her answer is no. No guarantee. Because after all, first of all, expropriating the bourgeoisie is the necessary but only first step. Far more difficult is creating new non-alienated human relations to replace capitalism. Moreover, she emphasizes, socialism cannot be created in one country, but can only come into an existence on an international level. A point that, of course, was agreed upon by all genuine Marxists before Stalinism. I quote her directly, quote, the socialist revolution can only be a result of an international revolution. And absolutely decisive is the level and form of development of class relations and proletarian operations in other capitalist countries, end quote. But if the transition to socialism cannot occur until there is an international revolution, how likely is it that the masses will be able to maintain their rule in any given country? Luxembourg is brutally realistic on this. She refers, I'm quoting her directly, she refers to, quote, the inevitable removal of the proletariat from power by a counter-revolutionary operation of the bourgeoisie if the revolution in Russia is limited to a single country. She adds, it may be in the end, after the proletariat is overthrown, that the republic will disappear. But this does not mean that the revolution will have been in vain, since, she says, if the revolutionary proletariat in Russia were to gain political power, however temporarily, that would provide enormous encouragement to the international class struggle, thereby inspiring new revolutions in other parts of the world to come. I find this a remarkable statement of realism in saying the odds are that we will fail to effect in Russia in 1908, or in the period around this, a genuine transition to socialism unless there's an international support from elsewhere in the world, but we still have to try to do it. Her discussion in the Three Dumas speaks directly to what happens a decade later, when Tsarism was overthrown in Russia in 1917, followed by the Bolshevik seizure of power, which of course she supported. Lenin and the Bolsheviks were fully aware at the time that the material conditions did not permit the immediate creation of a socialist society in Russia. That is, of course, why Lenin worked so hard to force the proletarian revolutions in West Europe. And on this, Luxembourg and Lenin are absolutely at one. No difference between them. However, the Bolshevik regime did not take the form of a democratic republic, as seen as its suppression of political liberties. Moreover, Lenin famously declared in 1918, I'm quoting him, quote, now that we have seized power, we intend to keep it permanently. This is the total opposite of Luxembourg's insistence that the inability of the proletariat to stay in power is not the worst outcome, so long as its creation of a democratic republic based on the rule of the working class inspires others elsewhere in the world to take up the fight against capitalism even after its own ship goes down. In short, she opposed sacrificing democracy for the sake of staying in power, since doing so only guarantees that a transition to socialism cannot occur. But if a radical regime that expresses the will of the masses exists, even for a brief period of time, it can help inspire the transition to socialism to later arise at an international level, instead of taking the other approach, which is trying to stay in power at all costs, which besmirches and undermines the very conception of socialism. Obviously, this is not the course that was followed by the so-called socialist regimes of the last 100 years. None were willing to take the chance of being voted out of power. But neither did any of them lead to socialism, as we all know. They instead led to various versions of statist capitalism that most of them mutated over time back into free market capitalism. The path intimated by Luxembourg is the one less traveled. But perhaps for that very reason, it's the one that we need to turn to anew. Antonio Gramsci once stated that history teaches but has no pupils. I hope that this generation proves him wrong.
Having a couple of hundred socialists sing happy birthday to me is one of my best birthday presents ever. So, okay. Look, Rosa Luxemburg was a rhetorically and figuratively powerful writer herself. She also understood the potency of language. And she grasped the central value of creative literature, both as a vital component of human life more broadly and as a tool for understanding the world and thus changing it. Now, bearing in mind Paul's warnings, I am not trying to turn Rosa Luxemburg into a literary scholar. She was actually quite scathing about the burgeoning institution of literary criticism in her time. In a letter, for example, responding to her beloved friend Hans Dieffenbach in 1917, she writes, "Your idea that I should write a book about Tolstoy doesn't appeal to me one bit." For whom? What for, Henschen? Everyone can read Tolstoy's books, and if the books themselves don't give off a powerful breath of life, I wouldn't succeed in doing so through literary commentary. She adds, I also regard the monstrous amount of Goethe literature, that is, literature about Goethe, as pure trash. And it is my opinion that far too many such books have been written.
Indeed.
She has no idea. At other times, Luxembourg lambasts the idea that fiction alone can provide a reliable picture of the world. In 1905, while sending frequent live updates from the revolution in Russia, as Sandra said, in which she was an active participant, she ridiculed, quote, bourgeois journalists who derive all their knowledge about Russia from the latest theater production of Maxim Gorky's Lower Depths or from a couple of novels by Tolstoy. Now, given these scathing sentiments, any attempt to turn Luxembourg into a literary critic, as she herself might put it, is not an attractive enterprise. Nonetheless, Luxembourg did produce substantial formal literary analysis over the span of her life, throughout her life, including serious assessments of the Polish poet Adam Mickiewicz, the great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy, and the Ukrainian author Vladimir Korolenko. And this commentary, along with constant literary references and allusions in the political and economic writings, and long discussions in the letters, demonstrate that she did take literature very seriously, which perhaps accounts for her distrust of the career critic. However, despite this rich potential, Luxembourg's discussion of literature has not really received very much attention, especially in English. So the Complete Works Project, by making the archives available in English, is really allowing us to make it easy to correct this huge oversight. The volumes that have already been published or are on the way contain diverse and varied literary allusions and references. These sometimes are made to illuminate historical conditions, and then other times to help crystallize a theoretical political insight. Even in the economic writings, which you might think are the least amenable, creative literature plays a really crucial role. Boccaccio, Dante, Moliere, Schiller, Defoe, Shakespeare, and of course her favorite, Goethe, are variously quoted, along with many other contemporary authors who are not familiar to us today. For example, she quotes a poem by Goethe in a discussion of the reproduction of Capital. Quote, the reproductive schema does not purport to present the moment of inception. Instead, it grasps this process in full flow as a link in, and this is Goethe, existence's never-ending chain. And in the middle of a complicated explanation of surplus value, she reaches for a line from Goethe's Faust, quote, there is still a leftover to be carried painfully. So in using literature in these ways, Luxembourg's actually within a long-standing Marxist tradition. She sometimes evokes an earlier allusion from Marx in order to suggest a connection between two periods of struggle. And it's apparent that literature was a significant part of the radical working class subculture of her own day. For example, Luxembourg describes the first issue of the journal New Life, which came out during the 1905 Russian Revolution. This issue included a satirical sketch by the writer Shirakov, The Eagle and the Hen, which supplied a parable for the shifting relationship between the working class and liberals. You can guess who the eagle and the hen is there. She later refers to the arrest of Shirakov, by the way, during the suppression of the revolution, which shows that some of these writers were themselves revolutionary activists. So Luxembourg thus is routinely drawing on the political potential of literature, but she also explores the unique possibilities of the aesthetic realm itself. The letters in particular reveal that she reliably turned to poetry and fiction at times of deeply felt personal and political loss and crisis. in the wake of the battlefield death of her beloved Hans Dieffenbach amidst the colossal historical catastrophe of World War I, and while herself in prison for opposing the war, she read Simplicius Simplicissimus, the 17th century novel by Grimmelshausen. In a letter to her dear friend Mathilde Wurm, Luxembourg describes this work, quote, as a vast and powerful portrait of the 30 Years' War era, a picture of the barbarization of society in Germany at that time. She then goes on to explain, I just read it all at one sitting, only in order to numb myself and be distracted, because I have been struck a heavy blow. Hans Dieffenbach has fallen. I know that life will go on, that one must continue and remain firm and courageous and even cheerful. I know all that, and will soon be done with it all by myself. She counsels her friend about the novel. I nevertheless advise you not to read it just now, because it would perhaps depress you very much. So the emotional force of great literature can evoke despair, bringing you into the horror of the world, and also relief, a kind of self-medication at times of acute pain. And this emotional intensity may be invoked by the subject matter, but also by abstract formal qualities. In a July 1917 letter to her confidant, Sonja Liebknecht, Luxembourg describes her reaction to a particular verse from Goethe that was running through her head. It was only the music of the words and the strange magic of the poem which lulled me into tranquility. I don't myself know why it is that a beautiful poem, especially by Goethe, so deeply affects me at every moment of strong excitement or emotion. The effect is almost physical. It's as if with parched lips I was sipping a delicious drink that cools my spirit and heals me, body and soul. And this just beautifully captures the capacity of literature to engage the senses and to impact us emotionally in ways that bypass intellectual processes. So as one would expect from such a formidable dialectician, Luxembourg holds together many contradictory insights. Literature can be traumatic and it can be healing. It can crystallize historical and theoretical lessons, but it is also distinct from the political realm. She was fiercely opposed to any tendentious uses of literature, and she was particularly angry at attempts to claim authors as socialists. The linguistic and audible qualities of each work are decisive, regardless of author or message, and social purpose may interfere with artistic integrity, but formal experimentation without ethical substance is equally hollow. And she grappled, finally, with the greatest contradiction of all, art's location in class society. She explicitly tackles this in the 1903 essay, Stagnation and Progress of Marxism. Her starting premise is that in class society, all intellectual culture is owned by and serves the interests of the ruling class. While workers, quote, create with their own hands the whole social substratum of this culture, they nonetheless are largely excluded from its benefits. And so long as capitalism exists, she writes, there can be no other culture but bourgeois culture. But culture is nonetheless deeply important to the project of working class emancipation. She writes, the utmost the working class can do today is to safeguard bourgeois culture from the vandalism of the bourgeois reaction and create the social conditions requisite for free cultural development. Luxembourg's approach to art is infused by this notion of the working class as protectors and inheritors of culture, which is ultimately tied to the centrality of the working class to human emancipation. She identified the many ways that literature can carry traces of revolutionary aspirations and struggles. This concept is at the heart of Life of Korolenko, which she wrote from prison during the final year of her life, which explores the tremendous power of 19th century Russian literature born out of opposition to the Russian regime. She writes, it created, in the midst of that huge prison, the material poverty of Tsarism, its own realm of spiritual freedom, and an exuberant culture wherein one may breathe and partake of the intellectual and cultural life. Socialists do not need political cover for appreciating art. As she writes elsewhere, the class whose goal is the renewal of the world can have no such narrow horizons. But, as with all other aspects of capitalist society, its full potential can only be fully realized when the oppressed have wrested control and ownership away from the ruling class.